profit in filmed entertainment came from animation, since the live-action studios actually lost money. In his annual letter to shareholders, Eisner glossed over mounting problems at Euro Disney. Disneyland was too expensive, he wrote. Walt Disney World's Magic Kingdom opened and the company's stock fell by half. It recovered quickly, I might add. Tokyo Disneyland threatened the very existence of the Oriental Land Company, and Epcot Center was the mother of all expensive parks. But like all good fairy tales, the company not only survived, but it is living happily ever after. Disney's annual report that year also disclosed that Eisner and Wells had exercised stock options on 6.6 million shares and then sold 5.1 million of them. The company attributed the sales to proposed tax legislation that would have eliminated corporate tax breaks on compensation over $1 million. Disney said the company saved $90 million in corporate taxes by having the executives exercise their options before the end of 1992. Of course, the timing was fortuitous, since Eisner and Wells were aware of the dire state of the live-action slate and the mounting problems at Euro Disney. Eisner realized $197 million on the sale, Wells $60.3 million. Combined with his annual compensation, Eisner earned well over $200 million, again placing him far ahead of any other corporate executive in America. Sandy Weill, then chairman of Travelers Group, was a distant second at $52.8 million. Although Eisner vaulted that year onto the Forbes magazine list of the 400 richest Americans, criticism was muted. After all, Disney's market capitalization and its stock price had jumped more than tenfold from $2 billion in 1984 to $22 billion just 8 years later. Nor was Disney's and Eisner's achievement simply financial. In Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, and Aladdin, Disney seemed to have conjured up the magic it so often talked about, producing deeply moving, critically acclaimed yet accessible films likely to become enduring classics. As Eisner had written while still at Paramount, "If we make entertaining movies, at times we will reliably make history, art, a statement, or all three. We may even win awards." With Roy as vice chairman in charge of animation, Katzenberg the de facto chief executive, and a remarkable team of talented producers, composers, lyricists, and artists, Disney Animation had become something like a symphony orchestra, finely tuned, perfectly balanced, and playing at the peak of its virtuosity. Eisner made that year's letter to shareholders a tribute to animation. "Your company has nothing less than the most talented, inventive, creative, original, resourceful, and brilliant people working in animation," he wrote. "I probably sound like the proud parent who indulgently shows off his children, even if they are decidedly not perfect. But The Little Mermaid in 1990 and Beauty and the Beast in 1992 were perfect children, conceived in love, 4 years in gestation, birthed comfortably and getting better with age." Noting that June 1993 would mark the 100th birthday of Roy's father, Roy O., Eisner continued that, "With all that Roy Sr. gave to this company, perhaps his number one legacy to our company is his son, our Roy, who did nothing